Hello and welcome to the Journeyman Podcast. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delving into the stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football clubs all around the world.
We'll look at club history from all angles, whether it be a team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
From our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes a platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories of tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations and everything in between. And we are back in Hull for part two, a little break, a little bit longer than we wanted to, but we're back and ready to dive into the second half of this fascinating story.
In part one, we learned about the club's early beginnings, with a fascinating war with rugby and the multiple places they called home. Plus, we spoke about one of their greatest ever escapes, defying relegation at the bottom tier of English football.
What a time to sort of leave it last time. Like, that was an incredible turnaround, and really, like you're going to see in the next sort of early few minutes of this episode, is how that sort of great escape shape what would become for the club and ultimately the city as well over the coming years.
Campbell to his left, Hull City's top scorer, Fraser Campbell, a slip by Lewis Carey. Windass! Quite simply, destined to be from Dean Windass. A clinical volley, a vital step forward, and who knows, maybe that's the moment from the hometown boy.
Before we pick up where we left off at part one after the Great Escape, we have to talk about one aspect of Hull City's early days that we unfortunately missed. Firstly, where the amber and black colours come from and the mistaken story of Hull's first ever colours being white.
Yeah, it's something that popped up a couple of times in our research, and like different sources saying different things. Like you say, that apparently the club hadn't always worn black and amber, and it was one thing when we got into this that even myself being from Hull, I couldn't have told you, you know, where black and amber came from. It was, so we were delving into this in Hull's first match against Notts County in 1904. They actually wore white shirts with black shorts and black socks. It seems to be pretty simple then, but little did we know it really isn't.
This original idea of Hull using white stems from two photos, one of a team wearing white shirts and another of a team in white, sat beside a team in Notts County-like black and white striped shirts. But when the team in white is actually analysed, it does not contain any Hull City players from that time. The two now historic photos are actually from a charity game to fundraise after the sinking of a Hull-based boat caused the death of two members of the crew.
And the game was played at the Boulevard between a Smurthwaite XI, the team named after a former board member and then prominent Hull City fan, and the Lady Madcap Company team. And this team was put together from a theatrical company that was performing a show called Lady Madcap at the Grand Theatre in Hull at the time. This fundraiser kicked off in 1906. And this date, like we say, it doesn't line up with Hull City's first game being in 1904.
It's debunked further by a newspaper report in which Smurthwaite personally thanks Hull City for allowing the team's use of the pitch, plus a loan of goalposts and a ball.
You know, why would the club thank themselves? And yet, this team photo in question, it only featured 11 players. It seems unlikely to be Hull City, because in fact in this first season when they were playing all of those crazy friendlies to try and build their reputation to get into the Football League, they used over 40 players. And there's one crucial bit of evidence that may point to the use of white, however. A newspaper report on Hull City's friendly clash with Bradford states, City turned out in white shirts. But also it says, as the Bradford shirts being very similar to those used by the home team. Which, when you think of that, a colour clash would make sense between Hull City and Bradford, and a reason why they would wear white. But it wasn't until 1921 that a ruling was made that an away team had to bring a change of colours if there was a clash. And before that, it was actually the home team's responsibility to change the colours. It's actually a change kit that they've worn at home because of Bradford City coming to town.
The last two pieces of evidence that confirm the use of the amber and black instead of white are from Hull Daily Mail, stating in August of 1904 that the Hull City team, we are informed, have decided to play in black and amber vertically striped shirts. Plus another team photo from that same day of the fundraiser that features a much bigger squad, which would match up with the nearly 40 players that Hull City used in their first season, but in this photo they're dressed in all black. The players featured match the Hull City team from the time, but what were they doing in all black? Well, it's probably a black and amber shirt, but unfortunately the photo is very grainy and causes both colours to look very similar. So, as we know now, the white was just Hull City's away shirt from the time, and on the basis of probability, amber and black was used from the very offset of the club's history, despite what other sources say, like on Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. And as we've delved into this, and like we say, we found out different sources, but we have to give a big shout out to Les from Hull City Kits for a fantastic archive and so many great articles on there, like really delving into the sort of depths, and it goes into far more detail than what we have. But yeah, it's a great resource for Hull City fans, and also if you're just a kit fan in general.
So back to the original question, Why black and amber for Hull City? Well, other than it simply being proposed in 1904, there doesn't seem to be much added information. This seems even stranger when, for example, the nickname the Tigers wasn't immediately their nickname from the off. The club's nickname from the very beginning was actually called the Citizens prior to the Tigers' nickname taking off in popularity just shortly after.
No one can exactly say why black and amber was chosen, but I think it seems pretty clear that the Tigers' nickname followed afterwards because of these colours. But yeah, it's hard to say.
So from this point, we jump back to where we left off at the end of part one. We continue on in the early noughties and we travel back to where we left off. So just after the Great Escape, despite conjuring up all that magic, Warren Joyce was out of a job less than 12 months later.
Despite the sort of good feeling factor that came over the club and the city after the escape, the club was still in a very precarious financial position, to say the least. And so much so that the club would actually be locked out of their own stadium by debt bailiffs who were acting on the orders of former owner David Lloyd, who still owned the stadium. And David Lloyd is an interesting character, a divisive character, to say the least, with Hull City fans. He's someone, you may remember him as being a successful tennis player in the 70s and 80s. But after his career in tennis, he opened up a chain of leisure and health clubs. And after floating that on the stock exchange, acquired something like £200 million. And this is where Hull City come into the picture. And he would buy the club in the summer of 1997 for £2.4 million.
He would begin his stewardship talking of the things like a dream super stadium and also hosting the rugby league there and a football team worthy of a city that's the seventh biggest in England. This would sound so good to the ears of Hull City fans, something reminiscent of Jack Walker's takeover at Blackburn not too long ago.
But it didn't take too long for things to turn sour, and just two footballing seasons actually. And he proclaimed in an article from The Independent, "The club is for sale. There is not one more single penny of my money going into this club." At this point, the club was running over budget by around £7,000 a week. And this is an incredible quote. He continued, "How can they generate money? I've been their Father Christmas and they want to get rid of Father Christmas."
Your young Hull City fans be like, who's Father Christmas? Is it David Lloyd?
David Lloyd coming down your chimney on Christmas.
In a city fearing the worst, the only noises are coming from dissident supporters anxiously trying to save their club. That's how it was described at the time, as they tried to wrestle back control of their club.
The guy that would replace Warren Joyce in the dugout would be the experienced Brian Little. And Little breathed new life into this Hull City team, managed to get some good results out of the players. Like we said, despite being briefly locked out of Boothby Park by bailiffs and liquidation constantly hanging over the club. And the club were eventually allowed back into the ground in time to recommence preparations for the 2000-2001 campaign. But the club faced mounting debts and the daunting prospect of a winding up order at the High Court in February 2001.
Lloyd sent in the bailiffs once more just days before the Tigers were due to entertain Leighton Orient at Boothby Park. And the club was placed into administration just hours before the High Court hearing. In hindsight, this act can be just seen as pure stupidity, as it can only be a massive amount of spite that's forcing Lloyd into acting this way. Another quote proves this, him stating, "I've had enough. Certain people in Hull don't want to listen to the facts. All the fans shout at me, get your checkbook out, get your checkbook out. But I'm the only person who has ever got his checkbook out. They don't realise how much I've spent, or they don't want to realise."
Father Christmas is all right, moaning bastard. But yeah, like you said, he's got this position of he owns the stadium, he doesn't have the club anymore, and it does seem pettiness, some kind of revenge. And unfortunately, that's something that Hull City will see from owners a couple of times over the years. But yeah, a two-week adjournment was granted in order for administrators to find a potential buyer for the club. And their first job was to negotiate with Lloyd in order to reopen Boothby Park. And they succeeded in this task, and the highest gate of the season so far gathered for this emotional afternoon, 10th of February, when the Tigers played their part in getting a 1-0 victory. And they'd actually go on a run of a sequence of consecutive league wins, 5, that had not been achieved for 16 years.
Off the field, the administrators received an initial 12 inquiries from potential purchasers of the club. They whittled these down to 5 offers and eventually recommended that one was suitable to secure the club's future. The day of reckoning was set for Thursday the 8th of March 2001. On that day, the creditors' meeting was held in a local hotel and 99% of them voted to accept the deal that would allow the club to continue.
This first hurdle to survival had been overcome and the spotlight now switched to the shareholders. And after some initial uncertainty, they also approved the deal. And Hull City were saved, subject to Football League approval, and would be under the control of new owners. The identity at this point, though, was still a mystery and remained so for a further 5 days. And it wasn't until actually the 12th of March that this mystery was solved, as Adam Pearson came to light, who was a former commercial director of Leeds United, and a press conference was called to announce that he was the new owner of Hull City.
So as much as Leeds United fans might not want to believe there is a connection between the clubs, whether that be through rivalry, this, unfortunately for them, ties Leeds United with Hull City, thankfully saving the club on this fateful day. With little remaining in the manager's hot seat, a remarkable season ended with the Tigers reaching the playoffs for the first time. After the drama of the previous months, a 2-1 semi-final aggregate defeat by Leyton Orient was a comparatively minor setback.
Yeah, with Pearson duly producing the goods that his predecessors merely promised, the 2001 closed season saw the recruitment of no fewer than 13 new players, and this new-look team held third place going into December, but defensive problems saw the confidence and results slip away, and as City drifted down the third division table, Little was replaced in April 2002 by Jan Molby.
The Danish former Liverpool star had established a promising managerial reputation at Kidderminster Harriers of all places, but struggled to halt the City slide despite another 8 summer signings. The Molby reign ended in October of 2002 as the Tigers languished in 18th place.
Pearson's come in, he's put his money where his mouth is, he's putting money there for players, but things are just not clicking. You won't find a Hull City fan that will disagree with this. Huge moment now comes, December 2002, when Peter Taylor gets appointed as Hull City manager. And around the time of his appointment, just Hull City relocate to this impressive new 25,000 seat stadium, the KC Stadium it's called at the time, after 56 years at Boothroyd Park. And, you know, all these ingredients are coming together now.
Let's give it its full title here, Mark. Kingston Communication Stadium. The idea of the new stadium was first mooted in 1997, but the funds to finance such a project only became available when the City Council sold a portion of its holdings in Kingston Communications.
I'm going to start rambling up, but like Hull is unique in the UK of, like, you know, the red phone box you see everywhere in England. You don't get that in Hull. We have like our cream coloured phone boxes because it's the only private telephone network. And the council sold their shares in it, which then funded a lot of things in the city, but one of the biggest ones, the stadium. They considered over a dozen different sites, like inside around the city, before, I think, very poetically setting like on the Circle, the former Anlaby Park ground in West Park. So all those years ago, I should say, in part one, we're back on that same spot in a brand new stadium.
There were a handful of obstacles during the course of the project, including Hull City's receivership in 2001, just after the granting of planning permission. Despite this, the stadium complex was completed on time after 14 months of work and on budget. The stadium officially opened its doors on the 18th of December in 2002. And while this modern new stadium was exactly what the club needed to be able to progress, the departure from Boothroyd Park was still a sad one. No matter how dilapidated the stadium had become in its later years, it was still a home to a club that had done so much during that period of time.
Yeah, and of course, there's many amazing memories live on in the hearts and mind of Hull City supporters. You know, that 55,000 crowd that we spoke about against Manchester United in 1949 in part one. We actually had a couple of listeners in between recording episodes that actually contacted us, telling us that they were at that game. Like one gentleman on Facebook who his granddad took in one of his first games, and he remembers sitting on the cinder track around the state. And also, you know, the first penalty shootout in England was at Boothroyd Park, also against Manchester United in 1970. And yeah, the Great Escape season itself. Amazing memories. But things have got to move on, and some of the attendances they actually had in this division, some of the best, you know, the city flocked to see this new stadium, but they were still unable to finish above 13th place in the table.
The initial progress under the management of Taylor proved to be steady in their spectacular new surroundings. Another summer of investment in 2003 saw 5 more players added to an already strong squad.
Peter Taylor's Tigers also developed a much more solid defence, which was reflected in consistency in a run of 16 games unbeaten from August to November, and another sequence of 7 consecutive competitive wins in January and February, which hadn't been achieved since the Rich Carter days of 1948 in part one. This confirmed the club's serious promotion credentials. This city renaissance, like we say, it saw the support swell like the gate of 23,000 against promotional rivals Doncaster in December 2003. Was the highest for a City home game since the visit of Manchester United in 1974.
The bar would rise even higher with the attendances to 23,495 in the April of 2004 for the visit of Huddersfield Town, a game that could have seen promotion secured. The champagne had to be left on ice for another week as the long-awaited promotion campaign was finally finished off in the unlikely surroundings of Yeovil Town.
Fittingly, it was a memorable goal from captain Ian Ashby that broke the scoreline and emotional celebrations in Somerset. Back in Hull as the game was beamed back live into the stadium as well.
Comes out to Ashby, picks it back into Junior Lewis. Might come to Ashby again, a curler from Ashby. Oh, what a goal from Ian Ashby! If we thought the goal at Southend was a classic, then that is even better! And that's a late contender for goal of the season, an absolute cracker!
As you can tell by now, the club have put together a great group of players, many of whom would be part of Hull City's subsequent and incredible rise after being on the brink of extinction just a short time ago.
Stuart Elliott, a flying left winger, Northern Ireland international. He joined City for £230,000 from Motherwell in 2002 and finished as the club's top goal scorer with 12 goals. This was followed by the 14 goals in this promotion season. He would take things to another level in the next season, in the club's first season back in the third tier.
After promotion, Peter Taylor wasted no time adding to his squad, and what would follow would be arguably the most sensational signing in the club's history.
One of Hull's all-time favourite sporting sons came home. Someone who'd never played for Hull City before, but a born and bred Hull lad. Nicky Bambi, his glittering career taking him from Tottenham, Middlesbrough, Everton, Liverpool, Leeds United. He's back in Hull. Less than 4 years after playing in England's iconic and massively important 5-1 win against Germany, he was proudly going to be pulling on a black and amber shirt in his home city.
This astonishing signing also coincided with the feel-good factor of the club's centenary season, 100 years of Hull City.
Signing someone like Nicky Bambi in the third division of England, this massively raised the expectations. This really upped everybody's ambitions. Early progress in the newly named Coca-Cola League One was very steady in the opening stages of the 2004-2005 season. But all of that changed a December night in South Yorkshire with a magnificent 4-2 victory at Sheffield Wednesday.
In front of just over 28,000 people at Hillsborough, City confirmed their promotion credentials for the second season in front of the highest attendance to witness a Tigers away league victory since the infamous Battle of Bramall Lane at Sheffield United in 1971. It moved the Tigers into second place behind Luton Town, who had been comprehensively beaten 3-0 at the KC Stadium just 6 weeks earlier. The Wednesday win was the second in a run of 8 consecutive league victories, making Taylor the first City boss to record a run of 7 or more consecutive wins on more than one occasion.
And that 8th win would come at Stockport County in January 2005, and the Tigers briefly went to the top of the table. And even though they weren't quite close enough to close the gap on eventual champions Luton Town, that was probably the only disappointment of this absolutely astonishing season, as the confidence Tigers strolled to the runners-up spot to complete back-to-back promotions for the first time in the club's history. So close to going out of business, they get one promotion and then another one comes straight after, and things are flying now in this new stadium, big crowds, incredible.
It was undoubtedly a collective effort to gain promotion, but for one player it was a particularly outstanding season. From his position wide on the left of midfield, Stuart Elliott contributed 29 league and cup goals. This included an astounding sequence of 17 games that he started, which produced 17 victories for City and 17 goals for the Northern Ireland international.
Obviously, I'm completely biased. I genuinely think this season Stuart Elliott had here is one of the most incredible seasons ever, because those stats you've just read out is already, it's mental. But he was out for like over 6 weeks injured, which meant he missed quite a few games, which he would have easily rewritten Hull City's scoring records.
And even more magically, Elliott would share the League One Golden Boot with a very familiar name to Hull City fans, none other than big Dean Windass.
The Hull-born striker was playing for Bradford City, and he scored 27 goals as they finished in 11th place. Dean Windass is someone who'd progressed through Hull City's youth academy, going on to score 57 goals in 176 league games before leaving the club in 1995 to Aberdeen for £800,000, a fee which remains Aberdeen's second highest transfer record, which we spoke out in great depth in our Aberdeen episode.
The KC Stadium provided the worthy backdrop for a promotion party, no Yeovil this time, with the promotion clinching coming as a goalless draw against Swindon Town in April of 2005. The final home game 2 weeks later saw the stadium attendance record raised to 24,277, with playoff-bound Sheffield Wednesday providing the opposition. So, 100 years after becoming members of the Football League, Hull City had placed themselves back where it all started all those years ago. Nick Barnby's decision to drop down to League One had been vindicated. The Hull-born hero scored 9 goals during this campaign, including the fastest goal in City's history after 7 seconds in a match against Walsall in the November of that campaign.
Tranmere have failed to win! Hull City are promoted! Hull City thank everyone for their support on a fantastic afternoon. Hull City will play Championship football next season. It finishes Hull City 0, Swindon Town 0.
And City would begin life back in the second division with 6 new signings for their squad, including Keith Andrews from Wolves and Stephen McPhee from Portuguese side Beira Mar. At £400,000, Stephen McPhee became the club's record signing. He'd made his name at Port Vale, scoring 44 goals in 3 seasons before jetting off to Portugal.
McPhee's final season at Vale saw him score 27 goals in all competitions. As the club missed out on promotion, obviously strong interest from above came in for the Scotsman. McPhee had rejected a new contract, and a British club would have been able to negotiate a fee with the Valiants before talking to McPhee. However, a foreign club would be free to sign him without having to deal with Vale.
And the cash-strapped club even rejected their £100,000 bid from Leeds United, branding it as an offer not even worth considering. But later that month, his agent negotiated a move to Béramar, meaning Vale lost the player for absolutely nothing. McPhee said at the time the move was not about the money, but about bettering himself. But the quite interesting part of this is his agent was a guy called Jonathan Barnett, who, on the other hand, he had some very strong words to say. He said, "Port Vale are a two-bob operation, and we are a major company. Their concerns, they can stick them up the ass." He sounds like a very charming character, and especially like now the number one most powerful sports agent in the world, according to Forbes. His first client was apparently cricket player Brian Lara, but he's made his name since then with lots of footballers, and even current ones like Jack Grealish, Gareth Bale, Loftus-Cheek, Pickford. And he was reportedly like the sort of mastermind behind the £86 million move of Gareth Bale to Real Madrid. But it would seem here a very different time with Stephen McPhee.
And then following on from this, there's an even more fascinating story that relates to McPhee that includes St Mirren and Ronaldinho. Yes, Ronaldinho, yes, that Ronaldinho. In 2001, St Mirren launched an audacious bid for the out-of-contract Gremio star Ronaldinho, who had just secured a £15 million move to Paris Saint-Germain. St Mirren wanted to help the Brazilian adjust to Europe by offering him the chance to play in front of the glitz and glamour at Love Street for a few months. However, the move collapsed due to the iconic midfielder being involved in legal troubles back in his homeland. Poor Stephen McPhee didn't stand a chance when he was signed instead of Ronaldinho, with his name forever being associated with the Brazilian. But fast forward back to his first season at Hull City. After four games, Hull's record signing suffered a knee injury and missed the rest of the season and even the start of the next season as well. Ouch.
Other notable additions to Hull's squad throughout the season would be John Parkin, joining from Macclesfield in January, and a very young Mark Noble on loan from West Ham. Yes, Mark Noble, he did actually make appearances to other clubs in his career, not just only West Ham. Coincidentally, another club we've also covered on the podcast, Ipswich Town.
However, we turn our attention back to Hull City's first season back in the second tier. As expected, the campaign turned out to be one of consolidation, as the Tigers comfortably secured championship status, even finishing in 18th place, 10 points clear of the relegation zone.
The highlight proved to be a 1-0 win against Leeds United, with a goal coming from John Parkin. And Stuart Elliott would once again finish as the club's top goal scorer, this time a much lower total, 7 goals. And after keeping Hull City in the division following back-to-back promotions, Peter Taylor at this point, as you can imagine, was a man in demand. And since 2004, he'd been combining his role at Hull City with the England under-21 managerial job as well, so his stock was very high.
Since 2002, Taylor had wiped away the negativity of the 90s and brought the club into a new era. Bumper crowds had packed out the new state-of-the-art stadium as they climbed the divisions, scenes incomprehensible just a few years before.
Clubs are interested, but a few weeks later, he was fully gone, and his destination was Crystal Palace, a club he actually starred for during his playing career, and Palace agreed a £300,000 compensation package with Hull City. We've seen this in pretty much every one of our episodes so far. It's very hard to replace a manager that has brought so much success or defined an era, you know, whether that's over 20 years or 5 years or 10 years, whatever. So the search for the new manager was on, and Adam Pearson soon identified his number one target, which was Phil Parkinson. And Parkinson had taken Colchester to promotion just weeks earlier, and after some heated and protracted negotiations, the former Reading player was installed as the new Hull City manager, with City actually also paying £400,000 in compensation. And ex-Bolton Wanderers assistant manager Phil Brown, who had recently departed his job as manager of Derby County, joined the club as Parkinson's assistant. Adam Pearson had stated his ambition to take Hull into the top flight for the first time in their history, and he believed that Phil Parkinson was the manager to do it. However, an absolute dismal start for the 06-07 season was hardly the form of a team attempting to gain promotion, and by the 4th of December 2006, Parkinson was sacked as manager with Hull in the relegation zone, despite having spent over £2 million on players. Through all of this, he's put his money where his mouth is, he's backed his managers, but the Parkinson appointment just didn't work out. Initially to replace him, Phil Brown was appointed as caretaker manager and immediately set about trying to keep the Tigers in the division, in the championship.
I think this has to come down to the mentality when you think about it. Obviously, when Hull had been going through the problems, you've got to imagine the mentality around the club was just pure survival. Just see what you can do. And then, no offence, when you set a claim like that of getting yourself promoted, when it doesn't seem to work quite well, I think you can maybe project that it was maybe a little bit too soon for the Tigers to maybe push up, get up into the top tier quite so soon, considering, as we've already mentioned, not too long ago, they were nearly falling out the bottom of the Football League pyramid altogether.
But just like Warren Joyce And the Great Escape, this was only 8 years before. So just like Warren Joyce 8 years before him, Phil Brown needs some master plan to escape from the drop. And with just one loss in his first five games, including wins against Cardiff, Burnley and Sheffield Wednesday, this ensured Brown was installed as manager until the end of the season.
A crucial piece of business by Hull saw former star Dean Windass rejoin the club on loan to try keep his hometown club in the Championship. Other experienced heads joined the squad, including Danny Mills on loan from Manchester City and Ray Parlour on a free transfer, which was one that I had completely forgotten about. And when you showed me this, I was like, oh my, that's not a photoshopped edit. That is Ray Parlour playing for Hull City.
Yeah, that really did happen. And like those signings there, it reads out like a TalkSport episode or something, like the names. But yeah, and Phil Brown also, something that would become quite common over these next couple of years, Phil Brown would pick up the phone to his old friend, his old boss, Sam Allardyce, and sign some players. They got the exciting Ricardo Vazte on loan, who I just remember being the first player I've ever seen where he'd have like the Hull City like black and amber socks on, but then like some like white socks over the top at the bottom, and it just made him look so flash, like what a guy. But yeah, home wins against high-flying Birmingham and Preston, coupled with vital away victories at Luton and Cardiff helped. The biggest thing that helps is the arrival of 37-year-old Dean Windass. And he would actually score 8 goals after joining on loan in January. And his most vital one of this loan spell would be in April 2007, the penultimate Saturday of the season, and the only goal in the away win over Cardiff City. This left Hull City 3 points ahead of Leeds United with a vastly superior goal difference, meaning virtually certain Championship survival.
And to make things just that much more sweeter for Hull City fans, when Leeds United were then unfortunately pushed into administration and therefore a points deduction was coming, safety would be confirmed for the Tigers. Phil Brown and Dino had kept Hull City in the Championship. In his absence, parent club Bradford City were relegated from League One to League Two, although unfortunately. Remarkably, Windass finished the season as both Bradford City and Hull City's top scorer for both clubs, with 12 goals for Bradford and 8 for Hull City.
That must have been a very painful blow for Bradford City fans, but yeah, incredible turnaround. Phil Brown has done the business. And after that miraculous survival, Phil Brown's biggest task at hand was surely to make sure Dean Windass would join the club permanently. And Hull and Bradford would enter protracted negotiations over the size of the transfer fee required to make this loan a permanent one. And in June 2007, it was completed, and Windass would join Hull City on a 2-year deal for an initial fee of £150,000. But it was also a summer of change at the board level, and Adam Pearson would actually sell the club to a consortium fronted by a guy called Paul Duffin, who became the new chairman of Hull City.
Pearson declared that he'd felt he'd taken the club as far as he could, and new investment would be required to progress further. Duffin's consortium had already made unsuccessful attempts to take over at West Ham United and Cardiff City. He immediately announced a permanent contract for manager Phil Brown, and he pledged investment in the team with the aim of achieving promotion to the top flight for the first time in the club's history within the next 3 years.
A big statement of his intent, and a day I can still remember very, very vividly, is Caleb Folan becoming the club's first ever £1 million signing from Wigan, the most expensive deal in the club's history. And other sort of high earners would come in, and I think no one can really compete with this name of former Nigeria captain JJ Okocha, and his former Bolton teammate Henrik Pedersen to almost double the club's wage bill. Phil Brown using those Bolton links again. But yeah, to see JJ Okocha wearing a Hull City shirt, incredible stuff. But the season didn't begin in great style with a 3-2 home defeat against Plymouth. And when the Tigers were beaten heavily back-to-back away games against Preston and Southampton in December, many questioned whether it was going to be another battle against the drop.
However, the arrival of Fraser Campbell on loan from Manchester United added some extra bite to the City attack, and his strike partnership with Windass would prove crucial after the turn of the year. Fraser initially joined in the October of 2007 on loan until January of 2008, and scored twice on his home debut in a 3-0 victory over Barnsley. Following this match-winning display against Wolverhampton Wanderers on Boxing Day, in which he scored one goal and assisted another, Hull expressed their interest in extending Campbell's loan until the end of the season, and this was confirmed late in December of 2007. In addition to Campbell and Windass, Caleb Folan came to the floor, and the Tigers had plenty of goals in their team all of a sudden.
And they'd actually go on an incredible run, which would see them lose just twice in 16 games from the end of January to mid-April, to fully establish themselves as not only a playoff contender, but automatic promotional candidates. And there's always that, the ultimate cliche of the Championship is there's always one side that just goes on a run, and this run they went on was astonishing. As Phil Brown's team marched up the table, A couple of new additions were added to keep the momentum going. We had Craig Fagan rejoin the club from Derby County on loan, Simon Walton on loan, and Neil Clement from West Brom. Clement actually joined for the remainder of the season, but as City's form brought them into promotion contention against West Brom, West Brom exercised an option to recall him, which I always think, like, that shows you that all of a sudden West Brom, the big boys of the Championship, are f***ing worried about, you know, like, you know, you can't have our player. But this squad had just the perfect blend of, like, grit, determination, togetherness. And as this momentum built, the whole city began to believe. You know, you still got to remember, this is a city that had never had a team in the Premier League. They'd never been above the Championship. And people were starting to believe.
A final day defeat at Ipswich would end City's hopes of going straight up, and they would be forced to go through the playoffs, facing Watford in the two-legged playoff semi-final. This being the biggest game in the club's history so far.
Phil Brown's side triumphed 2-0 in the first leg at Vicarage Road, thanks to goals from hometown boys Nicky Barmby and Dean Windass, leaving City just 90 minutes away from a first ever Wembley appearance. A fantastic night at the KC Stadium is in store, but Darius Henderson scored a goal after just 12 minutes to set the Hull nerves jangling, while giving Watford fans hope that a comeback was possible.
But Nicky Barmby drew Hull level with a scrambled 43rd minute header before Caleb Folan headed Hull in front after 70 minutes. Richard Garcia then added a solo third, and Nathan Doyle's deflected shot made it 4 in injury time. Dreamland for the Hull fans.
Windass underneath it, but Bromby beats him in the air. Dawson returns it well to Merritt's header, not convincing. Garcia's there! It's over the keeper! And it's there! Richard Garcia! And Nicky Barmby, maybe with a final touch, just might, they just might have sent Hull City to Wembley, you know.
And this meant that Hull would have a chance of playing for the top flight football for the first time in their history, and their opponents in the playoff final would be Bristol City. Winning this game, it was estimated to be worth at least $60 million to the successful team, which seems quite quaint now, isn't it? It's like worth about 100 and something million now, isn't it? But yeah, Hull had finished 1 point and one place ahead of Bristol City, and 4 points behind Stoke, who were promoted in second place, and 6 points behind league winners West Brom. So very, very tight at the top. But what I quite like is first and second promoted, and then third and fourth were the teams that made it to the playoff final, and Bristol City had beaten Crystal Palace in their game, winning 4-2 in aggregate.
This was Bristol City's first Championship playoff final as well. During the regular season, the two sides had played out a goalless draw at the KC Stadium, and Bristol City had won their home game 2-1, so mentally maybe you're thinking Bristol City might have the advantage here.
Hull's lineup would remain unchanged from their semi-final second leg, and just what an occasion, kicking off the game in front of a Wembley crowd of 86,000, nearly 87,000 on a bright, sunny day.
Unfashionable perhaps, uncharted certainly, but there will be a new destination for the Premier League sat-navs next season. Will it be a new Western outpost though, or will it be the East Riding of Yorkshire? One thing is for sure, for both clubs, this is quite simply the biggest match in their history.
Am I right in thinking nearly three times the size of the KC Stadium there, probably?
Yeah.
A huge crowd. A game with few instances. That was until the 38th minute, however. A cagey game was brought to life with a moment of magic and a moment of history. Adebola lost possession, allowing Hull to counter-attack. Fraser Campbell skipped into the penalty area, spun back and chipped the cross to the edge of the box. Windass met it emphatically on the volley and it flew past Adriano Basso, 1-0 Hull in the playoff final.
A slip by Lewis Carey. Windass! Quite simply, destined to be from Dean Windass.
What a goal, just what a goal. Like, even when you're describing it, then I could hear the commentary and I could see it, like, yeah, what a moment. A huge goal, and of course it's written in the stars that Windass or Barmby was going to score, but yeah, Windass does that. It's an incredibly skillfully executed volley, which is, yeah, it's been replayed time and time and time again. Hull City would make it to halftime holding a 1-0 lead. Bristol City would press after the break with Hull keeper Buzz Myhill saving from Lee Trundle and Michael McIndoe. Tenor also blocked Trundle late on as the Tigers held on to join West Brom and Stoke in the top flight for the first ever time in their 104-year history.
Hull City are in the Premier League, and that is something that no one has ever said before on anyone's listen. Dean Windass's wonderful, magical goal, the cleanest and purest of strikes, has meant that his boyhood dreams and that of a footballing city have come true here in North London this afternoon.
Windass had cost Hull 150k, or just 0.25% of the prize for promotion. The scenes of jubilation at the final whistle showed what it meant to the Hull City supporters, and as they savoured the prospect of welcoming the cream of the Premier League to the KC Stadium.
Their ascent from the bottom division of the Football League to the top division of English football in just 5 seasons is the 3rd fastest ever. And after the game, Windass said, "It feels unbelievable. I don't think there's anyone left in Hull today looking at about how many supporters we've got here."
Chairman Paul Duffin, clearly getting his little ground-hopping hat on here, said he couldn't contain his delight after the victory, stating, "It's great for the city for us to be going to Old Trafford and Anfield next year. Everyone's been magnificent and I've been proud to be part of this team. This is for the Tiger Nation, past and present." How do you feel about that, Mark? The Tiger Nation?
This is a commonly used for the Tiger Nation. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thousands of fans lined the streets of Hull to greet their heroes 48 hours later, while behind the scenes, preparations for the club's first ever season of top flight football were underway.
Welcome to the era of the Premier League for Hull City, as they announced they had managed to sell out over 20,000 season tickets sold in one go. Hull expressed a strong desire to retain Fraser Campbell, with the chairman stating that he was too good for the Championship. Following his successes leading them to promotion, Hull were hoping to secure either a permanent move or another season-long loan, depending on Manchester United's willingness to let him go.
Despite bidding a club record £7 million, and this is just a crazy, you know, we're literally talking about the season before, it was the first ever £1 million player, and you're in the big time now, bidding a club record of £7 million for Fraser Campbell. But instead, he would sign for Tottenham Hotspur on a season-long loan as part of the transfer that took Dimitar Berbatov to Manchester United for £30 million. But this is the kind of playground Hull City are playing in now. But Phil Brown would add plenty of new faces to his squad, most notably Brazilian Giovanni, Bernard Mendy, Anthony Gardner, Paul McShane. And despite being a firm candidate for relegation ahead of the 08-09 season, Hull began life in the Premier League by beating Fulham 2-1 on the opening day in their first ever top-flight fixture.
Having gone 1-0 down inside 10 minutes as well, Giovanni scored Hull's first ever top-flight goal from outside the box to equalise. Caleb Fallon then won the match late on after Craig Fagan capitalised on a defensive mishap by Paul Konchesky. Only 3 players that weren't at the club the previous season started the game against Fulham.
Yeah, they've kept this core together, and Ian Ashby, who'd captained Hull to promotion from the bottom division of English football all the way to the Premier League. In this game, he completed an achievement that is very unique in English football. So captaining the team through all 4 divisions of the Football League, bottom to top, which is incredible. And Andy Dawson, Buzz Myhill, who I already mentioned, and Ryan France, they also played for Hull in all 4 divisions. And after that opening day victory against Fulham, City would draw 1-1 with Blackburn and lose at home to Wigan 5-0. But then comes this amazing upturn in form with a 2-1 win, away win against managerless Newcastle, a 2-2 draw against Everton, and then came 2 of the most memorable Hull City victories.
The Tigers travelled to the Emirates to face an Arsenal team brimming with talent, including the likes of Van Persie, Adebayor, Fabregas, Gallas and Theo Walcott. And it would be Arsenal who took the lead in the 47th minute when Cesc Fabregas' shot found the net via Paul McShane's legs. But City fought back in stunning fashion, thanks partly to a Giovanni screamer from 25 yards out on the hour mark, before Cousins' well-placed glancing header from Andy Dawson's corner. William Gallas clattered the crossbar in the 83rd minute, and Boaz Myhill even denied Fabregas at the death. But then it was over. Hull City had taken a magical 3 points on the road at Arsenal. And nothing sums up Giovanni more than that incredible goal he scored against Arsenal. Just wow, like an absolute wonder hit.
With a surging run, Giovanni going for goal himself and scoring an absolute belter. What a wonderful strike from Giovanni.
Pretty much everybody who was listening to this knows that goal. Like,
I'm sure it also helps that this is the era of prime Barclays, as many people would just understand, just this is Barclays Premier League football right
this
now.
This is ultimate Barclays. And he would actually be the star again a week later, as Giovanni would then score a 30-yard free kick against Tottenham to make it back-to-back wins in London. The Hull City fans were worshipping the Brazilian, and they still do to this day. He would add another 6 goals during the campaign, cementing himself definitely as a legend and a star of that first season. So despite being favourites for relegation, City continued to defy the odds. With only 1 defeat in their opening 9 games, they found themselves temporarily joint top of the table, 3rd on goal difference, following a 3-0 victory over West Brom. 10 years previously, they were bottom of the 4th tier of the league. Sadly, the club's form could never replicate the heights of the early autumn, winning only 2 more games over the remainder of the season. But one highlight of this dismal run was on Boxing Day, away at Manchester City. And no, we're not talking about another on-the-road away win, but a very famous half-time moment, which I'm pretty sure you're going to know where we're going with this one.
It was half-time at the then-called City of Manchester Stadium, and it saw the Tigers 4-0 down. Hull at this point had only lost one away game all season, but Phil Brown decided to have his half-time team talk on the pitch. The players sat around him in the circle as an animated Brown wagged his finger in protest at the lack of energy and passion that they had given to the shirt in that first half.
Like you said earlier, prime Barclays moment. And he stated in his post-match interview that after losing 5-1, you've got 3,000 or 4,000 fans who travel from Hull, probably made arrangements about their Christmas day to get to this game on Boxing Day. You can say it's uncharacteristic, but our mentality was not right today. I've had a harsh few words with the players today and they deserve it.
Fast forward towards the end of the season, and despite the drop in form and a slow slide down the table, City went into the final game of the season in 17th place, above the drop zone.
They ultimately lost the game against Man United 1-0. However, Newcastle and Middlesbrough, also losing against Villa and West Ham, secured City Premier League football again for another year. And despite this nerve-jangling end to the season, this didn't stop Phil Brown from getting on the microphone post-game to thank the fans before bursting out into songs of "We Are Staying Up" and singing and all sorts. He's never one to shy away from the centre stage. But the crucial away win at Fulham in March proved to be so important, with Manucho, who joined on loan from Man United, scoring a 90th minute winner, something that he's still remembered fondly by. Manucho, whatever happened to him?
Tried to repeat the trick of Fraser Campbell of loaning a Manchester United striker, it seems. An incredible debut season in the Premier League, as well as an FA Cup quarter-final for the first time in 38 years. The 08-09 season was certainly one to remember for Hull City fans.
But of course, with every high like that, there's not long after a harsh knock back down to reality. And narrowly surviving that previous year, Phil Brown had hoped to make some quality additions to his squad. A frustrating summer would follow as City missed out on countless targets, as well as seeing some of their long-serving squad members leave the squad, like someone like Michael Turner being one of the biggest losses. Stephen Hunt would prove to be a good addition, but the lack of firepower up top really plagued the club all season.
After just two victories in the opening 10 games, Chairman Paul Duffin resigned from his post at the club and was replaced by the familiar face with the return of Adam Pearson in the November of 2009. A run of four games without defeat in November did spark a mild run of form as they returned to the scene of their Phil Brown talking down 11 months on. Sean Wright Phillips had put Manchester City 1-0 up at the end of the first half. But as the game trundled on with a solitary goal, Hull began to believe. But when Kolo Touré fouled Jan Vennegård of Hessling in the box, it gave Jimmy Bullard the chance to step up to the penalty spot. He fired home the spot kick to level, and as he raced to the Hull City fans behind the goal to celebrate, he is collared by his teammates and realises it's the perfect time. His teammates all sit around him, and it's this time it's Jimmy Bullard's turn to give them a good old f***ing, with a beaming grin on his face as he wags his finger at every single player around him. Just as the original incident went down in folklore, so did this response. Bullard claims it was Paul McShane who cooked up the idea, and in fact, Brownie, as Jimmy calls him, took it well with a simple, "Won't be much more of that, will there, Jimmy?" post-match after the Tigers claimed a point at Eastlands.
Jimmy Bullard's gone on to make a career off this celebration, and lived on for many years in the minds of younger fans, so been included on the FIFA games and things, and Bullard later said, "I should be getting some royalties out of that celebration. I was walking down the street with the little one and had these kids just jump and sit down around me and start filming, like, tell us off, tell us off." But not much longer afterwards, during March 2010, Phil Brown would actually be relieved of his duties after a run of four defeats left Hull in the relegation zone. And his replacement was named as former Crystal Palace and Charlton Athletic boss Ian Dowie. And he was famously given the title Football Management Consultant during his time at Hull. This is due to, like, Phil Brown was not actually, like, fired, but put on gardening leave, so they had to give him this weird title. Hull fans were pretty disappointed by this appointment, hoping for a bigger name. And as could be predicted, relegation from the Premier League was confirmed in May 2010 after a 2-2 draw against Wigan Athletic.
After a summer of speculation, it was Nigel Pearson that would be promoted as the club's new manager in late June, and he took City to an 11th place finish in his first season in charge. A season during which the future of the club had once again been threatened by financial troubles.
At the 11th hour, the Tigers were purchased by the Alam family, who stepped forward to become the new owners in December 2010. As far as footballing matters were concerned, Pearson's reign as manager ended in November 2011 when he returned to former club Leicester, leaving hometown hero Nick Barmby to take temporary charge of first team affairs. After a successful couple of months, Bambi was handed the role as manager on a more permanent basis, leading the Tigers to an 8th place finish, with a playoff push falling short in the final few weeks of the season. But in May 2012, it was reported that Bambi had been sacked by the Lambs following a disciplinary meeting with the owners, following an interview he'd given to a local newspaper.
So it feels like the Lambs have only been in charge for less than like 5 minutes in our podcast here, and they've already fired a club legend and, I'm guessing, pissed off the fans.
Appointed him and fired him in very quick succession.
However, in the June of 2002, Steve Bruce was appointed as manager of Hull City on a 3-year deal, an appointment which would prove to be pivotal in the club's history. The 12-13 season was set to be Hull City's third consecutive season back in the Championship.
Bruce would guide Hull back to the Premier League in his first campaign as manager, and this was achieved in dramatic fashion by drawing with league champions Cardiff City on the now infamous final day, requiring a late Leeds United goal to fend off Watford from second place. In that final match of the season, Proschwitz would score a vital 58th minute equaliser against Cardiff City. The goal was only a third of the season in the league, and in the same match, he had a penalty saved by David Marshall, and if he'd have scored this goal, it would have meant a promotion. Subsequently, Cardiff countered, gained a penalty of their own, and scored to make it 2-2. There'd be another 15 minutes of anxious waiting for Hull players, staff and fans for Watford's loss to Leeds to be confirmed, meaning Proschwitz's penalty, it wasn't ultimately significant. So a big sigh of relief for Nick and the whole of Hull.
So thankfully, the Hull City fans could look forward to a new season in the Premier League after automatic promotion.
This season would actually end up going down as the Tigers' highest finish and points total on record, as Steve Bruce guided them to 16th place in the Premier League. But this season is remembered more fondly by City fans for what the club achieved in the FA Cup. They entered the competition at the third round proper stage, with matches taking place in January 2014. The draw for the third round took place, and Hull were drawn away to Championship side Middlesbrough.
Hull winning the match 2-0 from goals with Aaron McLean and Nick Proschwitz. This set up a reunion with former manager Phil Brown for the first time, as Hull were drawn away to League Two team Southend, City leaving it until the second half to break the deadlock, when Matty Fryett scored both goals to take the visitors into the next round.
The fifth round match took place at the Falmer Stadium in February 2014, and a replay would be required. Hull started the replay with first half goals from Iluka and Robert Corran, with Ajoa scoring again a second half goal for Brighton. Hull went through to the next round with a 2-1 win in the replay, and they would actually face Steve Bruce's ex-club Sunderland in the quarterfinals. Things are starting to get very, very real now.
The match took place in the bright sunshine at the KC Stadium, and both teams struggled in the first half to make any impact. A penalty was conceded by Sebastian Larsson of Sunderland, but Sonny Oluko's shot was saved by Oscar Ustari, leaving the match goalless at half-time. In the second half, Hull would take the match away from Sunderland with 3 goals in 10 minutes by Curtis Davies, David Myler and Matty Fryett. The semi-finals are on course and people are daring to dream now.
So the draw for the semi-final took place immediately, and they were drawn and paired with local Yorkshire club Sheffield United, who were in League One at the time. And of course, the semi-finals also take place at Wembley as well, a venue that had been so kind to them a few years before in that playoff final against Bristol City. Hull City had once previously reached the FA Cup final, where they lost after a replay to Arsenal in 1930.
In the semi-final match, Sheffield United started as the better team and took the lead through a Jose Baxter goal. Hull will level the score just before half-time through Yannick Sagbo, but United would be quickly back in front when Stefan Skugel struck to leave City 2-1 behind at the break. Bruce would make 2 half-time changes, bringing on Matty Fryett for George Boyd and Sonny Oluko for Manor Figueroa.
Matty Fryett would make an instant impact, scoring the next goal before Huddleston scored a classic solo effort, and Stephen Quinn headed home as well. Jamie Murphy would get one back for Sheffield United to make it 4-3, but City would seal it with a David Myler goal in adding time, giving Hull a 5-3 win, and a first appearance in an FA Cup final in their history. And so the date was set 17th of May 2014. The Tigers would face Arsenal at Wembley, kickoff time 5 o'clock.
It was the 133rd FA Cup final, with Hull making their first ever appearance in the showpiece since they were founded in 1904, while Arsenal equaled Manchester United's record of 18 final appearances. This historic match would kick off in front of 89,000 spectators, and it wasn't long before City fans would be on their feet. In the fourth minute, a corner from Quinn found Huddleston on the edge of the Arsenal box, and his shot would be diverted into the goal by Chester to give Hull a 1-0 lead. What a start. Surely it couldn't get any better than this. But 3 minutes later, Huddleston struck a free kick from the right-hand side of the pitch into Arsenal's penalty area that the defenders failed to clear.
Alex Bruce headed the ball goalbound, and Fabianski pushed it against the post before Curtis Davis struck into the goal from close range to make it 2-0. And like, this is definition of dreamland, isn't it here? And in the 14th minute, they were even close to getting a third goal after Alex Bruce's header from a set piece was cleared off the line by Kieran Gibbs.
It's towards the head of Myler this time. He let well.
Did.
This is Quinn. He's gone away from Ramsey. He's found a cross and it's headed downwards and against the post. And in! Curtis Davis has made it 2 for Hull City.
But with the 2-0 lead, Arsenal would start to show their class. Santi Cazorla, the Spanish brilliant midfielder, would whip in a free kick from 25 yards out and make it 2-1. Thankfully, Hull would make it to half-time, still leading 2-1.
Got to say, definitely one of the biggest 15 minutes of Steve Bruce's career coming up, his talk in that changing room. And after the break, Arsenal would pile on the pressure with a flurry of more chances. And with 18 minutes of the match remaining, Arsenal would equalise to make it 2-2. The second half ended with the scores level and sending the match to extra time.
And just when you would have thought maybe this is where Hull could maybe hang on, maybe take it to penalties, or, you know, pull up a magical winner in extra time, unfortunately it just wasn't to be. In the 109th minute, Giroud's back-heeled ball to Ramsey would be struck firm and low into the goal and make it 3-2 to Arsenal. And in the final minute, Fabianski saved a shot from Aluko, and the match unfortunately would end 3-2 with Arsenal winning and lifting the FA Cup.
You know, City, they were so close to this miracle, and Arsenal came and snatched it all away, and it was cruel, it was painful, but the underdogs fought and fought until they had nothing left all the way through extra time. People like Curtis Davis, Alex Bruce, Myler, they were all superb, undeserving losers, and the efforts of those 14 players was ultimately not enough, but I think you wouldn't find a City fan or even any neutral that could say, like, everybody was so proud of what they did. They gave absolutely everything. They stood toe-to-toe with a team that was regularly playing in the Champions League, and they provided Arsenal with a scare that they really hadn't seen coming.
The final whistle saw the players in black and amber crumble to the floor, but regardless, Steve Bruce after the game would be disappointed, but did say, in terms of effort and endeavour and determination, you couldn't fault them to a man. Proud, he says to himself questioningly. He says, of course I am. They were magnificent.
One little detail that would actually soften the blow and make this a little bit less painful was the fact that Arsenal had already qualified for the Champions League via their league position. And so the FA Cup winner usually gets the Europa League spot. Arsenal don't get that because they're already qualified for the Champions League. So Hull City would enter the 2014-15 Europa League in the third qualifying round. So there's no trophy to take home, but European football is coming up next season. Actually, a change in UEFA rules would actually see this is the last season where this was allowed to happen. It doesn't happen anymore, where like the qualification can drop down to the loser of the final.
With European away days on the calendar, so I'm imagining Hull City fans, you know, they'd be thinking of potentially where are they going to be travelling to, you know, a Spain or a Portugal, a France or a Germany. Unfortunately, the location of their first team wouldn't be quite as glamorous as those locations, but let's not put them down. From the team from the Slovak Superliga, it would be FKAS Trenzin, who qualified second in their domestic league.
Yeah, and the away leg would finish goalless, with Tom Huddleston seeing his penalty saved before he hit the rebound over the bar. And in the second leg at the KC Stadium, Hull were behind after only 91 seconds. However, goals from Ahmed Al-Mohammadi and Sonny Luka ensured Hull's progression to the playoff stage. Their playoff opponents would be KSC Lokeren, winners of the 2013-14 Belgian Cup.
Away in Flanders, though, unfortunately Hull would lose 1-0, with Hans Vaneken taking advantage of a blunder by City goalkeeper Alan McGregor. Bruce's team selection would be criticised as indecently weakened, with the same article questioning how seriously the club were taking this qualifying stage of the tournament.
In the second leg, back in Yorkshire, Robbie Brady scored twice. However, Jordan Remickle's goal proved crucial, as the Tigers were limited on the away goals rule. A very short stint in Europe would be a precursor to a decline over the coming season. And it's a shame that you never played in Europe before and then it's over so fast. Like, but something that had been bubbling under the surface over the last year or so was the club owner Asa Milan's desire to change the club's name. In 2013, Alam announced that the club would discard its 109-year-old name and henceforth be marketed as Hull Tigers to national and international audiences. Announcing the change in the Hull Daily Mail newspaper, he said, "Hull City is irrelevant, it is common. I want the club to be special. It's about identity. City is a lousy identity. Hull City Association Football Club is so long, it's too long."
The announcement stated that all references of AFC on the club branding will be phased out. Almost immediately, the club's website URL was changed, along with many other references to the word City. Alam, speaking in another interview, predicted that in a few years, many clubs will follow and change their names to something more interesting, and I will have proved that I am a leader. Remarkably, he would go on to add that if he were the owner of Manchester City, he would change their name to Manchester Hunter.
I love the idea as well. As you know, as we sit here, like now, you know, we can look back and it's easy for us to say, as Man City sit here after winning a treble, as Manchester City, this historic treble with Guardiola demolishing the league. And I just love the idea that Pep is still up every night, like, oh, I just wish we were Manchester Hunter. Like, make everything so much easier. Alam's plans to change the name of club were met, obviously, with strong opposition from supporters of the club, who's completely dismissed, stating, "Nobody questions my decisions in business." In response to the formation of a group opposed to the name change, called City Till We Die, Alam responded that the supporters involved can die as soon as they want. And this is the frustrating thing going on here, of like, Hull City are having this historic rise, their best ever Premier League finish, FA Cup finals, going into Europe, and all of a sudden, like, this stuff is seriously distracting things.
After the far-reaching City Till We Die campaign, which saw fan support come from around the world, including banners with the likes of No to Hull Tigers being displayed at the likes of Strasbourg, FC Sampaoli and FC Köln, amongst many others around Europe. In the April of 2014, the FA rejected Alam's proposal, thank God, to change the club's name. One smart decision there from the FA.
This first European campaign and pre-season had been somewhat undermined because, despite the FA rejecting and he can't change the name, he introduced a new club badge which removed the name of the team completely. Throughout this, the Alam family's relationship with the supporters continued to suffer, with many fans beginning at this point forward and over the coming season beginning a boycott that would last many years. He says the rebrand would have been a textbook move. You can't be in the Premier League and be Hull City or Hull County. It is textbook in marketing. The shorter the name, the quicker it grows around the world. Look at Sky, Apple. You don't act small club, you act globally. Otherwise, there is no point. If you are below the Premier League, you are a local club. You should act locally. He was so bitter about this, so bitter, and a lot of it stemmed from the council refused to sell in the stadium, and this was just him throwing his toys out of the pram of where a lot of it came from. And, you know, all of this off-field carnage really didn't help. And Hull were relegated from the Premier League after the 14-15 season, finishing 18th with 35 points. Relegation was confirmed after they drew 0-0 at home to Manchester United, and fellow relegation candidates Newcastle beat West Ham 2-0 to survive.
Despite all the off-field problems, Hull would actually secure immediate promotion to the Premier League, winning 1-0 in the playoff final after Mohamed Diami scored in the second half with a long-ranged effort. And what should have been an exciting summer with Premier League football back on the calendar, it was marred by rumours of discontent behind the scenes once again. After no transfer activity, leaving Bruce with a squad of just 13 players, in which a few of them were also injured, Bruce resigned from his position as manager due to the alleged rift with the club's owners. And I'm not bloody surprised, to be honest.
Yeah, and this just set up a summer of chaos as the Alam family really did wreak havoc on the club. Hull City had not even reached the airport when it became clear this pre-season tour of Austria would just be a disaster. Keith Birchin, a first team coach for the previous 4 years, had turned up with his luggage, only to be informed his services were no longer required and the team bus, he was told, would be going without him. He wouldn't be the only absentee as City made their final preparations for the 16-17 Premier League season. Like I said, manager Steve Bruce had already walked away 12 days before this, as well as Mo Diame, who scored the goal in the final, the Wembley hero. He actually decides that instead of going up to the Premier League with Hull, he's going to go join Newcastle in the Championship. There was still no manager appointed. There was rumours of Roberto Martinez, Zola, but Mike Phelan, who had been Bruce's assistant for the last 18 months, was appointed as caretaker manager.
The Alams had placed the club in such a toxic environment that at this point, all local media had been banned from attending the stadium and had a massive falling out with the council who owned the club stadium after they refused to sell it to him. And now, iconic image of that pre-season tour with just 9 players ready to take on in a pre-season friendly summed up the situation perfectly.
9 players in this picture, no permanent manager, and Curtis Davis was the first to upload the picture on social media along with the caption, "Hull City squad photo 2016-17. Several more, including Livermore and Sam Clucas, then followed suit to create national headlines. On the opening day of the season, Robert Snodgrass's winner would earn a 2-1 victory over Leicester before the team spirit and enthusiasm won out again a week later when returning home with Swansea with a 2-0 victory. But only then did the sort of disaster of pre-season start to catch up with them.
One win in the next 18 games left them bottom of the pile at Christmas and staring down the barrel of relegation. The team spirit had been forged together strongly amid the chaos of their pre-season in Austria. But City's failure to prepare for the season eventually caught up with them with predictable consequences.
In October 2016, Phelan became Hull's permanent head coach, but he was sacked just 3 months later in January after very little improvement. Marcus Silva was appointed as replacement just 2 days later, but could not prevent relegation at the end of the year.
Thankfully, the Alam's ownership of the club would again come under scrutiny in the summer, where upwards of 7 key first team players were sold during the transfer window for around £45 million. Hull again started the season with a threadbare squad depleted by injuries, and and made a poor start to the season back in the Championship under manager Leonard Slutsky.
Yeah, he was sacked just months into the new season in early December, with the club having been on a poor run of 2 wins in 15 games and firmly in a relegation battle. The club was still for sale in 2017, with AC Milan stating the club is no closer to being sold. Alam has cited issues with the club stadium and the militant fan backlash surrounding the potential name for the reasons why the sale has been delayed. Nigel Adkins would lead the team to avoid relegation and finish 18th the following season, despite being the relegation zone after 19 games. An upturn in form saw the Tigers finish in 13th place. However, Adkins resigned at the end of the season after rejecting a new contract, after falling out, of course, with the Alams, stating that his and the club's futures were not aligned.
Grant McCann was appointed as the head coach on a one-year rolling contract. Unfortunately, by this point, the Hull City manager's job had become one of the most difficult and toxic positions in English football. Nobody wanted it due to the Alams, simply put, and the people who take that job would usually be seen as the Alams man or their man or just a yes man type of figure. The team made a promising start to the 2019-20 season, however, and were in 8th place after a win at Sheffield Wednesday on New Year's Day.
And I think this is one of the more shocking pieces of like asset stripping of the Alam reign. It took place as star man Jared Bowen was sold to West Ham and the club's second best player, Kamil Grosicki, moved on loan to West Brom, both on deadline day. And it can't be stressed how important these two were, especially Jared Bowen. So, you know, they're sitting around there, 8th place. Playoff push could happen. And City's form nosedived. They lost 16 of their last 20 games, a run that included their worst league defeat ever as they lost 8-0 away at Wigan Athletic. I think this is one of the lowest moments in a very long time. And in July 2020, after a 3-0 away loss to Cardiff City, Hull were relegated to League One, finishing last in the division. So they've gone from being playoff contenders in January to relegation, literally dead bottom of the league.
Despite it being the club's first time playing in the third tier of English football in 15 years, McCann, working on a shoestring budget, would bring the club straight back up at the first time of asking. In the April of 2021, Hull were promoted back to the Championship after a 2-1 victory away at Lincoln City, and the following 3-1 win at home to Wigan Athletic saw the Tigers crowned EFL League One champions.
It was actually the club's only fourth ever league title that they've won, the most recent since the victorious 65-66 third division campaign 55 years prior. But you know, even winning this, the mood is still so negative.
After what had been a desperate slide down the divisions for Hull City, finally a grain of positivity looked like it was coming their way. On the 19th of January in 2022, after months of rumours, negotiations and speculation, Turkish media mogul Ajun Ali and his company Ajun Media completed a takeover of the club, ending the club's controversial 11-year ownership under the Lam family.
It's a weird moment because obviously like Hull City fans, they've got their club back. And I just think like the Alams is just such weird behaviour because they could have been remembered. There's an alternative universe where there's like a statue of him in Hull because, you know, the promotions, the first ever FA Cup final, got into Europe, and the bitterness, both of them, destroyed any kind of legacy and any kind of, I don't know, love or any positive thing anyone could ever say about them. And so Ajun coming in, he could have done anything. He's already an instant hero.
The Hull City first had Father Christmas ruining the club, and now the Alams have tried their best, but now it's time for a new Turkish era here at Hull City.
And at the time, the club actually sat 19th in the Championship as the takeover was announced. And in January 2022, manager Grant McCann and his assistant Cliff Byrne left the club, with Shota Avraladze, the ex-Ranger striker, announced as new head coach. At this point with Grant McCann, it was a little bit harsh in terms of they just put like some good results together, but like especially with McCann, he was seen as the Alams man, and so it was never going to work.
Hull City would achieve Championship survival in the 21-22 season with a 19th place finish. However, in the September of 2022, Ajun Ali's first managerial appointment would be sacked after a run of 4 league defeats, and former fan favourite Andy Dawson was appointed as interim head coach.
And in November 2022, another favourite, another old boy, the club announced Liam Rossini as the new head coach in a 2.5-year deal, with Dawson staying on as his assistant. Having strengthened both the team's defensive record and the team's away record since his arrival, Rossini managed to guide Hull to a comfortable 15th place finish by the end of the 22-23 season. It sounds quite weird, but even for like me and you living here in Berlin, we feel the effect that Ajun has had on Hull City very much so, don't we? Like we mentioned at the start of the first episode, positivity and how basically it's pretty much everybody in Turkey, unless you're a Galatasaray fan, pretty much everyone in Turkey's second club now.
Under the ownership of Ajun Ali, the club's positivity is back. The club seems to be pulling themselves up the championship table. I think Ajun has had a very easy time of it in terms of that he's just had to reverse a lot of the terrible decisions that Lams had spitefully put in place. For example, the returning fan media, the return of local media, easy win there.
Can definitely tell since he's come in that he is a media mogul and he knows just done things right. Like, I remember when he first landed at Humberside Airport in his private plane, he had like the old Hull City badge stuck on the side of his plane, and it's like obviously fans instantly gonna think you're great. But also even things like, you know, he's at some of the local fan pubs before games, and he took a lot of fans on holiday to Turkey. Yeah, and he just seems like a guy that genuinely does care. And I think at first, like, a lot of fans were like, God, this guy seems amazing. And after what happened with the Lambs, it's like, but we don't want to fall in love with him too soon, because, you know, who knows what might happen. I think everyone has given that up now. It's like, this guy's just a legend.
You'd like to think as well, with him being such a big media mogul, that even if things aren't going 100% correctly, he will be as media trained as possible to like keep it together, rather than the weird spiteful tenures of Father Christmas, David Lloyd and the Alams, in which, yeah, they were resorting to behaviour that was that of a child spitting out their dummy. So we're both incredibly happy to see the Ajun Ali tenure seems to be taking off slowly, and Liam Rossini in the following season has got them in the championship playoff spots as we record.
Like you say, when you look to the future, at the moment they're in the playoffs as we record, with a manager who the fans also have a huge connection with. Like, Liam Rossini was playing in that FA Cup final, like, he was there for some of these great times. He also has this emotional connection to the city. His nana's from Hull, as there's a great song on the terraces. And I think one of the more exciting things that I think has gone slightly under the radar is, like, since Ajun came in, there was rumours of a behind-the-scenes funder, someone in the shadows putting some money in, maybe. And more recently, Hull City announced a sponsorship deal with McVitie's Biscuits, which sounds funny at first, you're just thinking of Hobnobs and things, but there's more to it, of like the parent company of McVitie's is owned by Ulker, who is like the richest man in Turkey, like, I think like $5 billion or something. It can't have been much of a coincidence that not long after this sponsorship deal was announced, around the same time, Hull City signed Jadon Villajean from Aston Villa for like £5 million, who's been setting the league alight the last few weeks. So I think there's a lot to be positive about as a Hull City fan right now. I don't know what your take would be for like looking towards the future. I think a playoff run would be amazing if they do that this season, especially to just have a year where you're not involved in any kind of relegation worries.
Unfortunately, this season they're going up against a fellow pod team that we've covered, Ipswich Town, who are flying at the top of the championship or up and around there as well. Obviously, Leicester City this season are doing really, really well. Leeds United will be punching, hopefully, to try and get themselves back up in the Premier League. So it's going to be competitive at Hull City, but I'm sure the Hull City fans can just rejoice in a nice positive era, an owner they like, players like Philogene, who is exciting to watch, and just enjoy it for what it is. Get those attendance numbers back up as they have been. The fans have been returning to the MKM Stadium in their droves with the return of Ajun Ali. It only looks like positive signs here for Hull City.
And of course, as we bring ourselves up to date now, the sort of end of our journey with Hull City, that brings us to our cryptic link of where we're going to be jetting off to next.
So, the link begins with one of football's founding fathers, Ebenezer Cobb Morley, was actually from Hull. The rules that he wrote would travel far and wide across the globe, as we all know today, including with an Englishman named Isaac Newell. He would take those rules to a certain part of the world and found a brand new club. And that is where we'll be heading to next time out here on the Journeyman Podcast.
So thanks for sticking with us through this journey. And I think it, despite being completely biased of being my home city, I think it's a pretty wild ride.
And for me, as someone who was discovering all of this for the first time, it is a roller coaster from the bottom, from the fourth tier, nearly going out of business, all the way up to the Premier League in one of the quickest times possible, and everything in between. It's been a lot of information to pack into this episode, that's for sure. And it's been fun.
Thanks for listening, and I'm sure we'll see you again on the next one.
Make sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. It really helps us climb up those algorithmic leaderboards. Share us with friends, share us with family, anyone who's a football fan who might have enjoyed some of this two-part story through Hull City. And check out our social media pages as well, obviously on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're always updating stuff on our ground hopping trips, next episodes on our football shirts and everything in between. So I think that's about it for Hull City here. This has been the Journeyman Podcast, episode 8. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
Have a good one, and we'll see you all guys next time for episode 9.